Welcome to Hoops HD, everybody. It is Monday, May 20th, and it's the off season, so we're not coming to you every week, but we decided to come to you at least once a month here, and we got a real special show with some evolving news that's literally just coming out today here. But let me start by introducing myself. I'm Chad Sherwood. Down below me is David Griggs, unfortunately. Next to me up here from Bracketeer.org is Rocco Miller and Galen Clavio back with us. Galen, it's been a long time since we've had you on a podcast, I think, but good to see you again as well. And we want to talk.
You told Galen I wouldn't be here. That's the only way he would agree.
I feel betrayed, honestly. Terrible. Yeah.
But I also promised no Missouri Kansas talk. So.
Yeah. Oh, wow. How long ago was. Yeah.
Jeez, we lost the show already here.
Right, yeah.
What we wanted to discuss tonight, though, was a lot of what's been going on related to NIL, the recent proposed settlement of the House case involving the NCAA, some of the ways it's been affecting even the upcoming season here with multi-team event tournaments now becoming NIL events, and I mean just the incredible changing landscape that we're seeing day by day. Leading closer and closer, I think, maybe to the death of the NCAA itself. But and maybe that's what we get to at the end of the show. But Galen, let me start with you. I know you've been up to date on all this. And kind of where do you think you see things standing right now, especially with the way the NIL is just getting bigger and crazier and the NCAA is losing more and more control of everything?
Yeah, it's a fascinating spot that we're in. I mean, you've got the NIL situation and essentially the rules that the NCAA put into place to try to regulate NIL a couple of years ago are unenforceable. They're simply not rules that anybody is interested in keeping up. And so you've got this arms race going on with college football, with college basketball. It's funny because it hasn't really I don't think it's really produced a whole lot of different outcomes. Like, the rich are still rich. You'll have a team like Arkansas or a program like Arkansas who throw a lot of money at college basketball, and that might help them for a couple of years, but it all more or less evens out. But now you've got this settlement going on in the House case, and this is all coming to a head this week. There's a deadline of Thursday of this week where the defendants in this case, the NCAA and the power conferences, are basically being told, you know, you can reach this settlement or not. And if you reach the settlement, there's a $2.7 billion retroactive payout to athletes that were in the NCAA for the past 10 years for missed opportunities to make NIL money. And then an opportunity essentially for athletes moving forward to opt in to what's estimated to be a minimum of about $22 million a year per school in payouts. No one quite knows where that's going to go. There's arguments over what's going to happen in terms of the settlement. It looks like the settlement's probably going to happen because the NCAA is terrified that if they don't settle, then they're actually going to end up with a judgment that could be significantly higher, which could lead to the direct death of the NCAA and the conferences. So this feels like, okay, we'll sacrifice $2.7 billion. I'd love to be in a position to do that myself. in order to try to preserve the enterprise. And I think the most important thing before we dive into the details is that even though I think the plaintiffs here have a really good case to take this all the way and get a much larger settlement, they also realize if they do that, they're going to kill the very thing that might get athletes money in the future, which is college sports and its current setup. They're pushing this in a direction where there will be direct payments to players. There'll be NIL money coming directly from schools as opposed to coming necessarily from collectives. At least that's their hope. If they push this too far, they could end up destroying the entire system. And so there's this delicate balance going on behind the scenes. That's why the settlement's happening in the first place. It's still going to be a mess because there's a whole bunch of other factors in play, but that's essentially kind of the Cliff Notes version of where we're at right now.
Yeah, and I guess there's a lot to dissect what you just hit us with there, but a couple of things here. And Rocco, let me bring you in here as well. Where we sit currently is with these NIL collectives, which are really, you know, maybe they're just a bunch of BS is what they really are. But
That's what I would
it's
describe
a
them as, yeah.
great. It's an attempt to kind of get around the rules that say you can't play athletes directly by allegedly having a bunch of people get together and say, oh, we are contributing to the NIL, and then every now and then the kid has to go out and you know, stand at a and sign a few jerseys or something like that, and so you're being paid for your NIL. But it's just a model, Rocco, that is not working, and I think that's the first problem we have with all this.
Yeah, I mean, like Galen alluded to from the higher level, it is unenforceable. And what that's creating more on the boots on the ground, your favorite team, whether that's a Power Five school like Galen and I are Indiana and Washington, both part of the future Big
Wait,
Ten, which is.
Galen's Indiana? I wouldn't have known. Why?
Well, actually,
What?
Chad, me, you, and Galen are all Big Ten now. This is kind of
We
crazy.
are
I don't know how this happened,
What a
but we
country.
have
Yes.
this is Indiana,
Washington, New
Washington, and
Jersey, same conference, no problem. Go ahead.
yeah, no problem. Well,
Marco,
I think we're.
you coming to Bloomington in October for the football game?
I'm actually trying my best. It's one of those like kind of weird ones that you just got to go do.
Yeah.
I'll be in touch. I'll be
Nice.
in touch as we get closer. But yeah, so like your favorite team is impacted by this because, and I can't truly speak to football, but you can make some football assumptions. Again, they have a lot more mouths to feed with 85 scholarships. But in basketball, you know, the good players, the great players are all very highly sought after. And, you know, depending on your school or depending on your collective, the you know, now that we have a year or two under our belt with NIL being a reality, not just under the table payments that we had for 30 or 40 years or longer, now it's all you know discussed up front. And what I'm hearing stories of as we go through scheduling for next year is a lot of players that were promised X, and at the end of the season they're getting Y for various reasons. It's not the same as X, so now players are starting to have doubt in the process. There's more and more. What do you call, you know, some of them are certified NCAA agents for NIL. They're supposed to all be, but then there's also, of course, all these AAU people, runners, people that have always been there, not necessarily the most trustworthy people. You know, we've had situations like down in Miami where the Life Wallet individual, Mr. Ruiz, promised X. Some of those players got X, some of those players didn't get X. And so now, you know, there's no accountability within kind of really any piece of this is what I'm getting at. And some of that, you know, they can pull the plug on a player. Let's say somebody's promised, you know, $100,000, but if the team starts 7-14, maybe that kid only sees like 30,000 for the whole year. Or maybe if the kid was promised 100,000, another example, but he only ends up averaging 12 minutes a night instead of 30 minutes a night, they might try to pull back some of those funds. So there needs to be a lot more player protections from their standpoint, and there needs to be more guardrails in place to enforce like any kind of agreement that's made, because all of that doesn't exist even on the basic like NIL collective to the player position. Now, maybe some schools don't have as many problems with that, but this is going on at a lot of places.
A lot.
And it goes in with the transfer market as well. I mean, you're hearing stories that
Yeah.
literally people are calling up schools and saying, "My great player is looking to transfer. He's got one more year of eligibility. How much money can you get him? Highest, because highest bidder is where he's transferring to." And that's worse than NBA free agency or pro free agency. It is literally year by year you could sell your services with no
You
guarantee that you pay
can't.
more than that year. Sorry, Griggs.
Yeah, that has been one of the side effects of this. But to echo what Rocco was saying, and this hasn't been in the news very much, but it's been going on for the last year or two, really, is there isn't anything really binding. An agent, an athletic department, whoever can promise them $100,000, but there's no binding agreement there. Like if you promise them 100 and give them 10, then there is no recourse. And a lot of the times they'll turn to the athletic department, to the coaches for help, and there's nothing you can do.
Well, I will add a couple of things on this. So there are these abuses do happen in some places, but there are some collectives that are doing it the right way, that are really organized. I
It's very important to point that out. I didn't,
I also think it's really fascinating. Like you mentioned this, David, there's nothing binding there's nothing binding the other way either. Like, I've heard a lot of stories of players who will sign NIL deals and they'll do essentially the absolute minimum. Sometimes not even that. There's no real additional buy-in as far as like anything other than like the one autograph session that you do for the $100,000 that you get. And even that can be like pulling teeth sometimes. It's a as Chad pointed out, it's far worse of a system than the NBA or anything else collectively bargained. But that's what the NCAA wanted. Like, it's funny, like they didn't want protections for players. They didn't want to give players legal advice. They didn't want to give players accounting advice. They were like, oh yeah, you guys want to make money? Well, you can do it on your own. Well, now they're doing it on their own. And everybody's like, oh my God, there's $2 million being paid to a Washington transfer to come play basketball, allegedly, which that's wild, Rocco. We need to talk about that story.
We needed that guy. We needed that guy.
You didn't see it. All of this could have been avoided if the NCAA had taken like an adult approach. But their whole stance in the run-up to the NIL stuff was players don't have any market value of their own, and players, all of the money that they would be receiving is because they're part of this particular athletic program, and if that isn't something that they can utilize and market off of and work with, they won't actually be worth anything on the open market. We've seen that's not true. Because it is so important for Power Five schools to have good programs in football and basketball. Of course, the players are worth a lot of money. How else do you get players?
Right.
And all that I think kind of leads into the idea now that the schools are going to run the NIL and basically play the players directly as part of this proposed settlement of the House case that we discussed, which was the lawsuit by the players who did not get money for the last 10 years and should have gotten money had the NIL been allowed. And I guess there's three parts of the settlement. One is this back pay of $2.7 billion. The second part is
They asked for four billion.
For $4 billion,
I mean, that's more than I make.
And it was a potential treble damage case as well, so it could have been
Yeah.
$12 billion. So it could have been
Yeah.
could have been amazing. And plus, as well as the new models going forward, but I think that this whole settlement now is also exposing a whole nother problem with the NCAA because all the smaller the way the NCAA is proposing to split up the settlement money. Of this $2.7 billion is to pay it out over 10 years, with the NCAA itself is supposed to be paying 40% of it. The other 60% paid out by the schools and conferences based on the units, basically based on the units that they received. And Grace, for people that don't know what a unit is that they receive, maybe explain that real quickly. I know you kind of know that answer a little better
Very
than I do.
quickly, in layman's terms, a unit is a men's basketball competition. It's paid to the conference. I believe the dollar amount is 1.8 million per contest. So if you get six teams in the NCAA tournament, three of them, if a conference gets six teams in the NCAA tournament, three of them win a game and then play again in the round of 32, that's nine units that the conference gets, and it's split evenly. I might be wrong on the dollar amount. It changes from year to year, but I believe, is that right, Galen? About
Yeah.
1.8 million. Yeah, okay.
And so basically, units that you got that you got, that's the percentage that your conference and your schools are going to supposed to be paying out.
Which is hilariously illy, poorly thought out.
Which kind of completely ignores that the majority of this money is going to be going to football players, and football does not factor into units.
Not at all.
This is where I think it's important for the
Yeah.
folks at home who don't
Yeah.
know to understand that the conferences and the teams specifically kept the NCAA out of football when they broke the NCAA's stranglehold on the football television contract in the early 1980s. They basically said all that power is going to revert to the conferences, or if you're Notre Dame, to Notre Dame. And that's how they organized it. They did it on purpose, knowing, and at the time, football made more than basketball. Now it makes significantly more than basketball, even though basketball makes quite a bit of money on its own. So when you see the college football playoff, when you see, anything involving football contracts, those are not going through the NCAA. And that's an important distinction because the NCAA only can control the revenue that it brings in, and it makes almost all of its revenue off the
All
men's
of it.
basketball tournament.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so, but this lawsuit does not involve just basketball players. It involves all athletes that could have been getting NIL money. And so when you're saying that when majority of the money that's being made in college athletics is being made by power conference schools in football, but that's not who's paying it out. And that's got the Big East real pissed off right now at this settlement.
Well, they should be angry.
But even a smaller conference, the Southern, the SWAC, the MEAC, they've got to pay out some percentage of money here, and it's not fair based on how much money these schools made. I get that.
Yeah, and the other thing about that, Chad, and it wouldn't matter which school it was, but of course, it's even worse that it's not power schools involved here. But the way athletic departments worked, and you many years ago, you guys used to have a guy named Andy Schwartz come on and talk about how athletic departments across the board have what's more of a spending problem than an actual budget problem. But when
Andy
they talk
still
about,
follows this.
Okay, hey, yeah. Hey, Andy, hopefully you're watching. but that's the thing is like once you make X amount of units in, let's just say last year's March Madness, 2024 March Madness, it's a 6-year payout system. So whatever the total money is, it's divided by 6 years. So you can go ahead and start spending more because you know those payments, you can count on those payments coming in. So the amount of back pay that they're going to ask those schools to make in the majority of cases, if not all cases, that money's already been either spent or accounted to be spent in some other budget. So it's not like they can go back and get that. Sure, they can find other ways to maybe get the money, but I think that just compounds the problem even further because of the way athletic department budgets are leveraged and spent as soon as they know a certain amount of money's coming in.
And I think it's helpful maybe to Chad to talk about what type of money we're talking about here. So the Big East right now, under the current proposal for this settlement, would have to sacrifice between $5.5 and $6.5 million annually of its total revenue take from its television contract. The smallest leagues, so I'm assuming here we're talking about the SWAC and the MEAC and things like that, would be about $2 million annually, which is that's about 20% of what they receive from the NCAA every year, which is a sizable chunk for conferences that don't have a lot of other money coming in.
Yeah. These are conferences that struggle to have decent facilities to play games. You may find that you can't find a final score for one of these conferences because they can't get their staff brackets set up. And I know Indiana or Washington or Rutgers is going to pay a lot more money dollar wise, but it's going to be such a small portion of the budget compared to these schools.
So this is where I say something unpopular on the show, which is the following, that it is unfair on its face. What was more unfair was all of these schools in the NCAA, including the schools in the small conference Division I's, conspiring and colluding to artificially restrict opportunities for athletes to earn money. In complete opposition to how the rest of the world operates, or at least the rest of the United States operates. And so while I am somewhat sympathetic to the Big East and some of these smaller conferences as far as the money that they might be losing here, the reality is everybody had an opportunity to say the current system is not right, it's not legal, this is not something we should be pursuing. They all chose to go in together and maintain the current system. So I have a hard time being that sympathetic given that background.
They all absolutely voted, hey, yes, we want to keep this system even when the writing was on the wall. So I agree with you there completely. But I think that the other thing here is Griggs, I know you were on Twitter today talking about this, is that now the NCAA says, well, we should get an antitrust exemption going forward and that will allow us to basically, you know, at least going forward, put a cap on the NIL going forward.
Yes. Yes. And this has been something, again, for a year or longer that the NCAA has chirped about, talked about. We need help from Congress in order to survive. We need an antitrust exemption. And they've actually, without boring you with the details that I'm not even sure of myself, have gotten lobbyists. They've spent tens of millions of dollars, ironically, that could have gone to athletes, but that's another side rant, to lobby Congress to give them an antitrust exemption. And I don't know, but before we came on the show, we were talking, and I asked you and you the question, Chad, what is their legal argument? Like, what could it possibly be? The only thing that I can think of is that college sports are considered an asset or a value to the country, and therefore, because it's an educational entity or some bullcrap like that, that they deserve some antitrust relief or exceptions. But the people with the legal-minded people like yourself, like Jay Billis and Galen, don't seem to think that this would ever happen.
I think you asked what is their argument, and I said exactly.
Stated what their argument is, and if they have, they haven't shared it with me. And sure, well, wouldn't you think they'd share
Galen, wasn't your response to their argument is we want it?
Exactly. And it's like, we really think we need this, guys, and hence we should get. Well, I will say, I think their argument is at its core that these aren't employees, they're students first, and then they just happen to play sports, which is a BS argument. It was BS when it was made originally 100 and some years ago. It's actually more BS now by a significant margin. But their argument, if you want to take that out to its logical conclusion, is that, well, we shouldn't have to consider these as employees. We shouldn't have to collectively bargain. We shouldn't have to pay them anything. And what we're finding is that there's, you know, A, it's not a good argument on its face, and B, there's just too much opposition because you've got the only people that can give you an antitrust exemption is Congress. And Congress is looking at this and like, this is like, this violates labor law. This violates a bunch of different standards that we have for how we conduct business across the board. If your argument is these are students, then why are you paying students on your campus for other jobs, but not this job? There's all kinds of holes in the argument. No one seems to focus on the holes. They just say, well, the NCAA wants an antitrust exemption. It's really, frankly, been poor reporting that this even gets an audience at this point, given how bad the argument is.
And Rocco, is that just the next step here? Let's just get rid of it and just call them employees and you know, call a duck a duck.
I mean, I thought we were already there like a year or two ago, but apparently we're not. And again, it seems like wasted money towards a problem that they can't ever get around because it would have to break all these standards across labor laws, as Galen just wonderfully said. So yeah, I think they're going to have to get there at a certain point, but I just don't understand like when it finally comes to an end and they snap the chalk somewhere and build a whole new legislation, which I thought they were going to be working on already. So
they're not,
but they're not.
and I mean, but
I don't know Galen, what to say anymore.
Galen, doesn't, if we just call them employees, doesn't that almost solve some of these other problems? Because maybe now we can give them contracts, and now we can stop transfers by locking them in for a couple of years, and we can fix a lot of other issues.
This is the core issue. I mean, here's the thing, and this is where a lot of the high-minded ideals of higher education have gotten in the way, where there's a bunch of people who are they actually, I remember sitting there at a dinner one time at the University of Texas, listening to our old buddy Chris Plonsky talk about this situation and how, you know, we're actually doing all these athletes a huge favor by even allowing them to put on a Texas uniform, like stuff like that. That is, it's like that South Park episode. Like, this is what these people actually believe. It is remarkable to me. There's also in the NCAA, I think it's important to remember a lot of the employees of the NCAA were Olympic sport or non-revenue sport athletes. They were not in a position to generate revenue. They really do look at it as a portal to a different level of professional employment. And it's a very different world if you're a gymnast or if you're, you know, someone from a swimming and diving team versus if you're a football or basketball player. And so the reality is that the NCAA, they've tried to shield everything under the guise of, we can make money off of the sports that make us money, but we're going to hide behind the sports that don't make us money as some kind of an argument against making the rules different for football or basketball. But what people care about in broad numbers is football and basketball. And so as a result, everybody hates the transfer portal. Everybody hates NIL. Everybody hates, unless you're with a program that's got $2 million to pay a player for NIL like Rocco is. Everybody hates.
Gotta do what we gotta do.
Yeah, everybody hates this kind of unrestricted free agency that exists constantly. And yet the NCAA is the reason why. It's not the athletes. I mean, I always talk about this in my class, and I'm like, you want to restrict transfers, but you're going to call the athletes students. Well, you're a student. You're a student. If you wanted to transfer tomorrow, you could do it without having to sit out. You wouldn't have to go get my permission as a professor to transfer from Indiana to Illinois. I don't know why you would do that, but you know, like you wouldn't need my permission to do it. You could just do it. You know, so you can on the one hand say, well, you're a student, and then restrict the rights of the students in all of the ways that we don't restrict the rights of other students to make money, to change schools, things like that. It's just at a more macro level. And so, as you said, Chad, acknowledging that these are employees allows you to collectively bargain, allows you to assign employment contracts, allows you to, you want to sign a player for 2, 3, 4 years. Great. You can do it. You can lock that player down. You can fire them for, you know, and release them from their contract for non-performance. You can trade, you can do all these other things. None of those things are being done because the NCAA and its member schools are hung up in this idea that they're not employees. And that ultimately is at the core of all of these issues.
Well, let me throw this out there then. Is a possible solution, instead of watching the entire NCAA fall apart, create some type of separate entity just for the revenue sports, just for the football and basketball?
I that is a good question, Chad. And my final thought would be to do it for football. One of the things that's created a lot of change, not just in what we're talking about tonight, but in conference realignment and television contracts and rules, the NCAA manual is about 443 pages this year, I think. I think 380 of them wouldn't be there if it wasn't for football and men's basketball, but particularly football. The reality is, when you look at football, the type of game, the schedule length, the roster size, the amount of revenue and interest that it generates, the amount of television that it generates, the amount of support staff that goes with it, it is less like any other sport. Basketball is a revenue sport. That is where the similarities with football end. It has more in common with rifle in every aspect than it does with football. Yet football is what drives the most change. My suggestion, and I'm not the only one that's come up with this, is what if football were to leave the NCAA? What if they just told the Power Five football or all football, you know what? We're done. Found the National Collegiate Football Association, the NCFA, and go do you.
I don't know that we're there yet, but
yeah, do your own conferences, make your own rules. You know, if you want seventh year seniors, go for it.
The problem, I mean, it's a great idea in theory.
Yeah.
But the problem is that most of the schools that have football won't be able to pay for the other sports if they don't have football.
Well, they would still have football. It just wouldn't be, it would be rugby. It would be boxing. But the idea, a collegiate sport.
The idea that football is going to make all that money and then give it to other programs at the same school, or a school's going to like have that kind of an arrangement, I just don't think is going to work. I mean, look, we see that in academic units. Like, we have a great business school here at IU. They make far more money than everybody else. They don't share that money. You know, it's not like, you know, they make money and then give it to the physical education program. I mean, there's a little bit that's taxed, but that's just not how these budget systems work. And
football makes a lot of money now, and they sort of share it.
You've got the problem with these huge conferences. How are you going to pay for the Washington bowling team to come to play at Rutgers if you don't have football and basketball money?
Well, they wouldn't be in the same conference for bowling.
The other issue here is Title IX, which is, right. I mean, you know, that's already an issue with athletic departments. How do you break that down? Like, is if you have a separate athletic association that's just football, I have a real hard time believing that people are going to be like, yeah, that doesn't count for Title IX. We'll just ignore that.
No, it would still count for Title IX the way it does now. What I kind of see is that football would continue to look like it does, but the other sports wouldn't. You wouldn't have Rutgers and Washington and Indiana in the same women's soccer conference. They would have more regional, you know, regional and traditional rivals and conferences than football.
Well, but the way I kind of see it,
Galen, is, okay, you know, there's 200, 250 schools that have rugby. It's not an NCAA sport. It has no interest in becoming under the NCAA umbrella. I think it's governed by the USR, and they like having a governing body that's only for them and only cares about them. But, same with cheer, same with dance,
but
same
those
with
are
boxing.
But those are all non-scholarship sports. Those are all, I mean, you know, here rugby's non, it's not a varsity sport. Cheer is not a varsity sport. What you're talking about would require a fundamental reorganization of college athletics from the ground up, getting away from this whole idea of varsity versus non-varsity. I have a hard time seeing the leadership in college athletics to allow us to do that. And it skipped
there,
over.
No schools give scholarships for rugby. I know some of them do for cheer.
I'm saying there are very few varsity rugby programs in the NCAA.
There's none.
Yeah, well, okay, but the issue there then becomes the way that the athletic departments themselves are put together. I think what you're going to end up with in that kind of scenario is a bunch of sports that end up getting relegated almost back to kind of a quasi club status, like somewhere between club and varsity, which maybe that's the way that we end up with. That was a prediction that was made to me by a member of an athletic department staff that I talked to a couple of years ago, where they were like, eventually we're going to have like three varsity sports and that's it. And everything else is going to be non-varsity. And it'll be kind of like if you're part of a club. The one thing though, and this is the important point from a revenue perspective, all of these television contracts are based on inventory. Big Ten Network, ESPN Plus, SEC Network. They're all based upon having all this inventory to sell to fill programming, both in streaming and in regular broadcast television. You need all of those other sports to fill that time. Like football can't fill everything. And if you're suddenly going to say this is part of a whole different equation, I don't think your television partners are going to dig that, because they're buying this whole suite of programming that they're then using to turn around and sell to advertisers and subscribers. So that's another layer to this that oftentimes doesn't get mentioned too much in the argument.
By the way, I was just looking it up. I see there's 13 current NCAA Division I schools that actually sponsor rugby, that gives rugby scholarships. So 13 of them.
How many do esports?
I didn't think the NCAA had rugby at all. There's no rugby championship.
Ivy?
It's schools that are members of NCAA Division I that give scholarships for rugby or another.
That's reported rugby.
Rocco. You know, what we've been talking about, a lot of people may think, well, this stuff is still going to play out over the next few years, and it'll be a while before this affects our day-to-day stuff. But it's actually, a lot of this stuff is starting to affect literally next season. I know you've been right in there with the MTEs, the multi-team events that we get early into the season. And those are starting to blow up in part because of NIL. You know, what are you seeing there?
I think the big story is pretty much all public now. You know, Norlander did a good job at CBS last week in kind of uncovering how the Players NIL Festival, I believe is what it's going to be called now, in Las Vegas, came to be. Essentially, you know, working with the same set of organizers, the people that run everything from the Maui Invitational down to, you know, the Baja Mar event down in the Bahamas, as well as the Battle for Atlantis. And after a while doing this off season, I get to know like basically everybody who runs events, at least in the destination space. Now there's two trends that I think are starting to take over the event space. But the NIL thing is having the greatest impact, because they are offering for all eight of these teams that are going to participate, the ability to earn up to $1 million is the right way to say it. If you read the article, so that's going to come through for each team. So that's $8 million total. You know, and that comes through a variety of activities, festivities, et cetera, leading up to the event. And then my understanding is there will be two separate pods and another $1 million that can be earned. I don't know if that's going to be $1 million per champion or $1 million broken up somehow.
We're now paying kids to win games, by the way, but go ahead.
In these right.
And,
and, yeah.
And it's it can't be phrased that way, Chad, but they're going to spin it.
I'm sorry. You didn't hear that then.
Yeah, that's okay.
Meet and greets. Come on.
I'm going to phrase it that way. We're paying kids to win.
Basically the initial thought, there's a lot of layers to this, so I'll try to cliff notes it as best I can. But the initial concern, especially across you know, every other organizer that's in competition for these same teams, like everybody wants Houston, everybody wants Alabama, everybody wants Creighton, you know, all these teams are going to this. And certain events lost out, like Battle for Atlantis just lost Creighton. That's unheard of. Nobody's ever backed out of the Battle for Atlantis. It's one of the two premier events along with Maui in the sport. You never see teams leave an ESPN event. You saw Texas A&M leave Charleston Classic to play in this. The San Diego had a reigning finalist in Purdue going to their event. And Notre Dame said, screw this. We're going to go play in this NIL thing. So it attracted.
Not a reigning champion. I just wanted to know that. Yeah. Okay. So
absolutely. Absolutely not. They did not get there. So the point is all of this stuff, at least for the event space alone, is unprecedented. And the money being promised, at least to the people that have been running events for decades or even just recently, the math is not mathing for anybody. Like in terms of, you know, we know if we get a team like a Creighton or somebody, it's worth, you know, we'll pay them $100,000-$150,000 to come down. We make that back in ticket sales, sponsorships, television, et cetera. And we hit the amount that we want to make as a company. But this number is about 10x that. And you start to dig into some of the details. And there are, you know, one of the companies that has been involved in events is part of it, but there is also another backer that comes directly from the UAE. And that has coaches now freaked out that, because there are some quotes out there from either that individual or associates of that individual, where they basically are saying college basketball is worth 10x what it's currently valued at. And we're going to come in with this, you know, Gulf money, oil money, whatever you want to call that. And basically, you know, and not to use the LIV Golf example, but coaches are freaked out that that's what this sport can become. If indeed this is somehow successful, somehow investors from the other side of the globe get behind it. And that is really what they're doubling down on with this one particular tournament. And in fact, they're so confident that they've already started to sign up to 16 teams for next year, which would be double the field. I think there's five or six already committed, including Syracuse and others. So this is happening very quickly. And the other thing that it's done to the entire tournament space is, as I mentioned, a couple teams lost teams. Some of those bigger events will be able to backfill. As you saw, Battle for Atlantis got Providence to take Creighton's place. So they're going to be okay for this year. But we saw tournaments like the Emerald Coast Classic. You know, SoCal Challenge was down here in California, did pretty good for the first couple of years. We have the Jacksonville Classic. There's up to five of these now that I'm counting, where basically the middle of these destination events are squeezed because they can't get enough teams to make sense of their own tournaments. And they're basically just folding up shop for this year, and maybe they'll never come back. So that's starting to happen to them. The other trend we're seeing, last thought here is, last year we probably had six or seven high major Power Five teams host their own tournaments. And now we've seen that number double. There's at least 13 this year. Probably 14. I just caught wind of another one in Arkansas who backed out of San Diego last week. So there's so much movement and shifting and other ways to bring in money. And that's what it all comes down to. And certain NIL collectives are offering more money for them to just play on campus than for them to go play in a destination tournament. So you're seeing a big shift and a big change to the sport just within tournaments. But of course, where you choose to play your tournament affects the rest of your schedule, because you want a certain amount of quad one, certain amount of quad two, and a certain amount of bad teams to get wins. So it's affecting every program at some level.
Rocco, I need you to just to clarify something that you said. There's money coming in from abroad, and the stated reason for it is because they believe college basketball is worth 10 times what it's being valued as.
Yeah, that's per the CBS article. It's in there, but yeah, I mean that's effectively what they're kind of doubling.
It's
down
not a global thing. Like
I don't know. I don't think it's that far off of a number, as weird as it sounds. And it sounds weird. Well, I'll say this.
Well, that's television talking. But yeah, go ahead, Gail.
This is. I think you can make an argument that, you know, college basketball, given the ratings it does get, and it gets pretty good ratings, all things considered, compared to other sports. It gets better ratings than professional hockey. It gets better ratings than professional soccer. but it's not been promoted well. There's no centralized office that promotes college basketball as a whole.
Well, there's
no
Hoops HD.
Right, well, there's Hoops HD. You're right. but it has been an under-monetized asset from a media rights perspective, and I kind of look at it the way I would look at like F1 or other sports that have much greater or had much greater reach than they were exercising, and then they got the right company in who was able to take that and go to the next level. Now that's frightening for people who have been following college basketball and like the way college basketball has been run. I don't think, even if you love college basketball with all your heart, I don't know anybody that would that could argue legitimately that it's been run efficiently or run in a way that or run in a way that maximizes its earnings potential. Now, part of the charm is that it isn't run that way, but that's, but that's different from saying that it couldn't be run that way. And I think that's where the investment's coming from.
And we've got one other point here. I think, Galen, is what I'm hearing this across all sports. It's not even a college thing only, is the fact that live sports is one of the few things where linear TV is still really in play. And that's where the money is, because the money's disappearing from everything else on TV other than sports these days.
It's not just linear TV. Streaming. And that's like linear is important because live sports programming is the only place where you can get people to watch ads live for 3 hours at a time. That is gold. I mean, I was listening to an episode of the Rewatchables the other day, and like the Oscars in 1994 were, I think they had 49 million people watching. And the Super Bowl had like 50 million people that watched or something like that. And now 20 or 30 years later, the Oscars have 19 million people watching and the Super Bowl's got like some ridiculous number in the US beyond that. So like live sports has become so important that NBC is about to drop like billions of dollars to grab the NBA contract away from Turner. That's not on accident. And, when you think about the amount of investment that Comcast has put into Peacock, that CBS has put into Paramount Plus, that ESPN has had to put not just into ESPN Plus, but also into its television properties and into ESPN Bet. They've made this huge corporate bet on betting. Well, that's live sports in and of itself, and you have to have a way for people to connect to that. And so college basketball, like, it checks so many boxes. It's a tidy amount of time. It's 2 hours a game. It's got regional rivalries. It's got stuff people care about to watch. They will tune in even when the team isn't good. They can bet on it live. It's got the greatest, arguably the greatest postseason of any sport anywhere. Like, there's a lot.
Since they row in the World Cup, absolutely.
Yeah, it's like, it is, and it's much more concise than the World Cup, weirdly enough, despite having far more teams. Like, it has got so many things going for it, and yet it's been run by the equivalent of, like, a mom-and-pop grocery store duo. Like, it's still run, to some degree, like it's 1975. So I don't blame the UAE or, like, investors from the Middle East saying, man, there's a lot of money there that we could make. Now, it will destroy the soul of college basketball, and that's the other part of it. But I get the argument that it's not being monetized properly.
Yes, on that note, I think we've beat this up as much as we can for now. I just want to run through each of you for any other final thoughts on anything we've discussed or anything else you want to mention at all. And Rocco, why don't I start off with you?
No, this was excellent. That was a great point, Galen. And I'll have a lot more calls like I've had the last 6 weeks with programs in all shapes and sizes, and maybe that will be something for some of these coaches to consider. But I think in general, if you're a mid-major coach and you're seeing this go down at the top of the sport, it's a race to get into the Power Five if you're them, which is why you've seen the last two hiring cycles, so many mid-major coaches just taking a lot of these jobs. We see Steve Lutz now at Oklahoma State. You see Byington at James Madison, Dusty May at Michigan. It's all over the place, and they've earned their chances. But that's why, the old days of back when Mark Few was at Gonzaga and turned down Power Five after Power Five, offseason after offseason, and finally turned Gonzaga into an elite program. Though that's never going to happen again because of the shifting landscape. At least at this point, Charleston had something brewing with Pat Kelsey. As soon as Louisville called, he was there, So that's kind of my final thought is, it's for some of these coaches, you know, in the mid-major ranks, you guys know this better than anybody. They're working 3, 4, 5 times harder than the Power Conference guys. The Power Conference staffs now are so big that I don't even know who to call because there's so many choices. It's like, wait, who's you're doing that? You're doing that? Okay. So it really is almost two different sports, the way these programs are being ran as we speak. But again, the lure of the sport, as Galen also did a good job pointing out, is the ability for that lesser team with the, you know, the lower amount of resources, but work their ass off to find a couple diamond in the rough star players can still beat those teams. And, you know, I would hate to see a world where they didn't have that chance anymore.
I agree completely. Galen.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, it's tough because we're at a fulcrum point for college athletics in general, and it's going to change drastically over the next 5 to 10 years. Now, a lot of it, I always make the analogy to Major League Baseball and what happened in the late 60s, where they just refused to work with the players. They refused to give more money for salaries. They refused to work with them on roster alterations. And then the courts decided it for them. And if you've been following this thing for the last 15 years, you could tell that this was where this was headed, that the courts were going to end up deciding things. And the NCAA did nothing because it's a huge body. There's 1,000 members plus of the NCAA. You're not going to get them all on the same page.
1088.
Thank you. But the reality is you got to get them on the same page. Otherwise, you let other people make the decisions for you. And look, I think for college basketball, which is obviously the raison d'etre of Hoops HD in the first place, I think the best we can hope for is kind of a European style system where, you know, you've got Premier League style conferences at the top, but you've still got opportunities for smaller conferences, whether it's through tournaments or Open Cup or things like that, to be able to get opportunities for shots against the big guys. But football and the money that football pulls in just puts most of those schools in a different stratosphere. And maybe that's how it should have been. You know, we've almost been living in a suspended reality where we got to live in almost a dream state for about 25 or 30 more years than we should have. I hate to put it that way, but it just kind of feels like that's the reality that we're living in now.
Yeah. Griggs.
Yeah. I'm two really good final thoughts. My head's still spinning about how they think college basketball could be monetized to the point of making 10 times. I definitely think it's been poorly run, but wow, that is sort of that's been kind of my brain's broken. My brain's small enough as it is. But anyway, like I Galen mentioned something about, will college basketball lose his soul? I'm normally not an optimistic person in general, or an optimistic puppet, I guess. But I kind of don't think it will. And the reason for that is because of all of the changes that we've seen recently. It's nothing like it was 5 or 6 years ago, but the feeling of it, at least for maybe not the diehard fans, but the casual fans that went to that school and like watching that team and like following them, still like to do so. People still watched the NCAA. It was still exciting. It still felt like college basketball. On this show, as you know, as all of you know, we have the Under the Radar podcast, which to me is the soul of college basketball. I know most would disagree with that, but that's really, I love, you know, the 22 under the, what we call the Under the Radar leagues. And it still felt the same when all of this started to happen. I was concerned that it wouldn't, but it still has. And truth be told, the players were mistreated. Galen already outlined that, but to amplify it again, they should have gotten more than what they were getting, and it should have started. It should have happened 30 or 40 years ago, not just 10. So I kind of am hoping that we can land in a place where it's good for the players, fair for the players, but it still has its soul. And I guess my question is, why can't we? Other than the NCAA is running it, which, oh boy.
Well, I guess the hope is that we led somewhere where we still have a framework of college basketball as it is now, and it does not blow up, which is things like the way that the Big East has reacted to the House settlement where we started the show off with, you know, gives me the fear that, hey, Big East doesn't like it enough. They could say, well, we'll go far from our own elite basketball conference, and there goes everything. But yeah. I hope we don't ever reach that point. But,
you know, it, love it's The NCAA. All right.
I guess on that note, I do want to thank everyone for joining us. On behalf of David Griggs down there, Galen Clavio, Rocco Miller from Bracketeer.org, I'm Chad Sherwood. We'll be back. We'll probably doing a podcast sometime during the month of June. Keep an eye on the site. Lots of good content on there as well. Talk to you again real soon.